Future from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. By The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community since 2003. By Fairpoint Communications, small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Green Mountain Power. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow, as well as over 750 VBSR members. Here is David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. On this Christmas Eve, day after Hanukkah, season of Kwanzaa, and the winter solstice, we're going to pause to tip our hats to some of the groups and people who are making a difference in the lives of others here in Vermont. We're going to tour around the state to talk with a range of people who are engaged in helping a variety of Vermonters, from youth at risk to veterans, children in underserved communities, to people of color and LGBTQ Vermonters. We're going to start our tour with the Children's Literacy Foundation, which is based here in Waterbury, Vermont. And we have Katie Titterton on the line from the Children's Literacy Foundation, or CLIF. Katie, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
David, happy holidays.
Thanks very much. Tell us a little bit about what CLIF does.
Well, CLIF is an independent nonprofit, and we've been around since 1998. Our mission is to inspire a love of reading and writing among low-income, at-risk, and rural children throughout Vermont. We also serve all of New Hampshire. And so the way we do that is we partner with organizations that directly reach those kids. So schools, libraries, shelters, Head Start programs, English language learner classrooms, any program that reaches kids who are at risk of growing up with low literacy skills. And we work directly with them to get books into the hands of kids and to increase kids' access to high-quality books.
So I understand since 1998, CLIF has served more than 165,000 low-income, at-risk, and rural children in nearly 400 communities across pretty much every region of the New Hampshire, Vermont, every part of the New Hampshire, Vermont region.
And that's right. There are very few spots we haven't hit yet.
Tell me a little bit about your work in prisons. This is one of the newer areas that CLIF works in.
Yeah, it is, actually. Our prison program just got off the ground in its current iteration this past year. And this year, we're really excited to be partnering with the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility. This is based in South Burlington. It's the only women's prison in Vermont right now. And we're partnering with Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility, or CRCF, and also with Lund, which has a program called Kids Apart that works with the mothers incarcerated in that facility and helps support them in relationships with their children. So what we do is we go in to the facility and we lead seminars helping the mothers there learn the importance of sharing books with their kids, and then also giving them strategies for how to do that, because a lot of people who are incarcerated tend to have low literacy skills themselves. It's actually 70% nationally of incarcerated people have low literacy skills. So giving people the tips to do that, to say it's okay to make mistakes, you don't have to read every word on a page, and just saying the most important thing is to share a book with your child, because the act of sitting and reading with them shows them that they're important, and it also shows them that you think that books and literacy are important. So we lead seminars, and then at the end, every mother there gets to pick books for her children and send them home with a note. And the way we partner with the Kids Apart program there is they have a storybook program where volunteers can go in and help inmates record themselves reading books on CD and then send those home with their kids. So we provide the books for the parents to be able to record and then send the book and the CD home together, which it can be really stressful for a kid to be separated from their parent, and that is a really valuable way to keep the connections going between parent and child.
I've had the good luck to spend a day with Cliff's founder, Duncan McDougal, visiting one of the rural schools that Cliff serves. And, you know, I was really struck by the image, first of all, that here in, you know, in our own state here in Vermont, there are some very small and very poorly resourced schools. And when Duncan pulled up with the boxes and boxes of new books, I just, you know, it was really very moving, you know, what that meant to the kids there. And I'm wondering, Katie, if you could tell me if there's an image that sticks in your mind about the difference that Cliff has made from your experience in doing the work that you do.
Well, David, one of my favorite anecdotes like that, I'm thinking about Gilman, Vermont, which is a town we served. We're not there this year, but we've been there recently. And as I think you know, and anybody who's listening in Waterbury has probably seen the Cliffmobile, which is a bright red Prius covered in decals of books. If you've seen it zipping by, it's probably a little weighted down on the back because there are probably about 1,000 pounds of books in there at any given time. But this distinctive car pulled up in Gilman, Vermont, in front of the school, and there was a boy sitting out front watching the car pull up, and Duncan got out of the car, and the boy said to him, "I'm so glad to see you. I love Cliff's books." And then he said to him, "All my books at home are Cliff books." And that has always struck with me, that there is a child, and there are many kids out there, who just don't have the access to books that a lot of people take for granted, and that every single book this kid had on his bookshelf at home had a Cliff book plate on the inside, was a book that he had received through a Cliff event.
Okay, well, Katie, we're going to wrap up our section with you here, but since this is the giving season, if people want to donate to Cliff, where can they and how can they do that?
Well, Cliff is an independent nonprofit. I should start by saying that we don't take any taxpayer dollars, so we appreciate every donation. It goes to the kids. It goes to buying books for the kids. And you can visit our website at cliffonline.org. That's CLIFONLINE.org. And I'd also like to really quickly, we have a bunch of independent bookstores around the state who are running book drives for us right now. So another great thing to do is to buy a book at an independent bookstore. They'll give you a discount, and that'll go directly into the hands of a low-income or at-risk kid who needs that book. So Bridgeside Books, I know Hayata's still got her giving tree up, and Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, Next Chapter in Barrie, Norwich Bookstore, and then Flying Pig just in Shelburne just wrapped up a book drive for us, and all of those books are going to the prison that we just talked about.
Okay, well, Katie Titterton, thanks for telling us about the Children's Literacy Foundation and the work that you do.
Thank you so much, David, and happy holidays to you and everybody listening.
Thanks very much, and now we're going to turn to Greg Stefanski, who is with Laraway Youth and Family Services, which is located up in Johnson, Vermont. Greg, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David. Appreciate being on the show.
I understand that the Laraway Center began in a barn in 1972 up in the back road of Waterville, Vermont. You've come a long way since then. Tell me what Laraway was founded to do and what you've evolved into today.
Sure. Our beginnings really come from one individual who wanted to make a difference. Her name was Rumsey Jesser, and she did pottery, and she had all kinds of other interesting projects going on in Waterville. And she became aware of some young people who had been kicked out of school and weren't really doing anything necessarily productive, and so she didn't know exactly what to do, but knew that she knew pottery and figured she'd give them an opportunity to do something with their time, and brought them to her barn in Waterville and taught them pottery. And from there, others joined in who wanted to make a difference and eventually made a connection with the Department of Education at the time to provide some reading supports. And that was the beginning of Laraway's school program. And that was back late 1960s and early 1970s. And so that same spirit continues today of amazing adults who come to work at Laraway who want to make a difference in the lives of kids and their families. And so they bring their unique gifts and talents. We focus on, we have three main programs. We have a school, alternative school, that's kindergarten through 12, on our 39-acre farm here in Johnson. We also support students in their public schools with one-on-one support. And then we also have a foster care program. So we have a network of foster homes up from Newport all the way down to the Barrie-Montpelier area and over to Burlington. And so the kids come to us for a variety of reasons. It might be that their family supports have broken down. It may be that they've really struggled in school and either, you know, caused harm to other students or teachers or staff or themselves. And but the commonality is that their community has broken down. That could be their family community. That could be their school community. And so what we really like to focus on is empowering youth and strengthening their families and hoping that the combination of those efforts will help kids build and strengthen their community.
We're talking with Greg Stefanski from the Laraway Center, for Laraway Youth and Family Services. Greg, how has the demand for the services that Laraway offers changed over the decades?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'd say it's significantly increased. So I've been at Laraway about 15 years now, and when I started, we were working with, I would say, about 25 or 30 kids, and primarily from across Lamoille County. And that's really shifted to a point where now we're working with about 130 or 140 kids at any given time, plus their families. And that's been another significant change in our work over the last few years, is that the expectation and the hope on the part of our partners, whether that's our public school partners or DCF social workers or other mental health providers, is that we will work and wrap a variety of supports around the students and the youth who are referred to us, but that we'll also reach out and help provide supports to the families of those students so that they can hopefully create a stronger family support network and provide a safe place for their kids to be. So the work feels like it's gotten a little more challenging, and we're doing a lot more work, not just within the county now, but up into the Northeast Kingdom. I think there's a greater awareness that there's a lot of need up there, but not as many supports and as much supports as folks would like to see. And as I mentioned, we're certainly seeing kids from across the state in our foster care program who've been through, unfortunately, some very horrific abuse and trauma, and whose lives have really fallen apart and need quite a few supports, whether that's a therapist, teacher, just a one-on-one support to help get through the day and hopefully move towards a brighter future.
When you encounter or meet for the first time, a child who really has been through some of these extremely challenging situations, what's the first thing that you do to kind of restore some order to their lives?
That's a great question, because when we meet young people, some of the kids who've come into our foster care program have been through dozens of placements in other homes or in residential programs, a variety of settings. They've maybe have been through just as many schools as they've moved around. And unfortunately, what we see in these very young people is they've lost trust in that adults are going to keep them safe and that adults are going to look out for their best interest. And so those first meetings are critically important. And I think our goal when we meet young people for the first time is really to listen and to find out what they're looking for, what's most important, in their world at that moment. And it might be, just wanting to know that there's going to be, a warm meal that evening. It might be a person that they're looking to connect with, a sibling. It's hard to believe, even in a state as small as our state, that siblings can get disconnected as these moves happen, and maybe one sibling's placed with a family member, another is in a foster home. We've seen young people at Laraway who were siblings but who had lost track of each other for years, you know, meet in the line at the cafeteria. And so sometimes that first driving desire is just to see a family member. And what we really try to do is be creative and flexible as we can to help kids get those needs met. And so that might be arranging a supervised visit. It might be trying to find out what's an interest that a child has, you know, something that they've enjoyed, you know, doing, so that we can hopefully give them some sense that what they want matters, and that they're going to be kept safe. And I think those are really those first primary focuses that we have when we're meeting young people for the first time.
Is there a story, a vignette you have of a child that you've worked with, or Laraway who's worked with, where you've gotten some sense of how you've made a difference?
Yeah, you know, there's one young man I recently had a chance to do a mock interview with him. He's getting ready to apply for some different jobs, and just an amazing kid. Again, really tough circumstances in his life, and unfortunately, neither of his parents was in his life and able to be there when he first came to Laraway, and the strain of all of his experiences as a child had really taken its toll even on relationships with other people and his family. And his grandmother was really the key support, who was still trying to hang on, but it had been a pretty tough ride. And this is a young man who came into our school program and our foster care program, and he had the opportunity to volunteer at a community lunch that happens at the United Church here in Johnson, and was just helping clean up, pick up plates, and make sure folks who had come to the community meal had what they needed. And someone from Sodexo, who runs the food service up at Johnson State and provides the food for that meal, noticed how hard he was working and the connection he was making with people who joined in. And he asked this young man, did he want to take some of the training courses, culinary training courses that they have, that Sodexo provides up at Johnson State. He took them up on the opportunity. Started working part-time up at Johnson State. He's recently transitioned from our school program to our local tech center and their culinary program, and is applying to go to NECI this next school year. And what was really exciting is he's doing very well in school. He and his grandmother have their relationship has grown, and they've both gotten the supports they need. But what was really really enjoyable for me is in doing this mock interview, one of the last questions was, where do you see yourself in 5 or 10 years? The sort of the standard conclusionary question for an interview. And his eyes just lit up when I asked the question. He said, I was hoping you were going to ask this question. And he went on to tell me this very specific plan that he had that included traveling to France to study culinary there, to open a restaurant in Colorado where he has a family connection, and eventually to come back to Vermont to open a French restaurant in about 15 years. And just to see the excitement that he had and the hope that he had for what he could do in his own life was very overwhelming, and certainly gave me and the other people who've been working with him a lot of joy that he's not only doing some great things right now, he's got a lot of hope and excitement for his future.
Well, that's a great story. For listeners who want to support the work that Laraway Youth and Family Services does, how can they do that? Where can they find out about giving?
The best way is to check out our website, which is www.laraway.org. A lot of really good information about our programs. It can sometimes be difficult to really get a full understanding of what mental health and treatment programs look like for youth, but there's some great information about our programs and some great stories of success for our kids, and also opportunities to give back. And we certainly encourage folks to, if they're in the Johnson area, a 39-acre farm. We'd love to have folks come by and visit.
Okay. Well, Greg Stefanski, thanks so much for telling us about Laraway Youth and Family Services.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful holiday season and New Year, and thank you for highlighting these great programs.
Okay, great. Well, now we're going to travel down to Brattleboro, where we're going to talk with Curtis Reed with the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity. Curtis, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us a little bit about what the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity does.
Well, we're a statewide organization, and we have a vision of Vermont, that Vermont is recognized as the epicenter of diversity, inclusion, and equity, that we set the standard and example for the rest of the nation. You know, for the people of Vermont, you know, we do work to strengthen inclusive and equitable practices as a means to eliminate prejudice and discrimination of all kinds. And we've been around since the mid-1990s. We're just wrapping up the first decade of a four-decade initiative called Vermont Vision for a Multicultural Future.
How do you do this education work? Where do you do it, and who are the people that you work with?
Well, we work with both community groups, community leaders, as well as state, regional, and local leadership around you know, how do you prepare Vermont for the ongoing changing cultural, linguistic, able-bodied, physical, changing landscape. We have a great number of transitions that the United States is going through, as well as here in Vermont, and we need our leaders of our institutions and organizations and civic groups to have a better understanding of what do those changes mean for not only their internal operations and what they do in Vermont, but also in terms of how they interface with the marketplace beyond our borders.
You work on diversity in a state not known for diversity. What challenge does that present, and how do you deal with it?
Well, the first challenge is that we are a much more diverse state than one would like to believe. And you know, recently, to sort of highlight that, last year we worked with the Department of Tourism to create the Vermont African American Heritage Trail, which sort of highlights, going as far back as the 1700s, the presence of persons of African descent have had in Vermont and the role that Vermont has played, in some cases the critical role that Vermont has played in advancing social justice, not only within our borders, but throughout the United States. We are very diverse, not only racially, linguistically, but in terms of our aging population, in terms of looking at persons with disabilities, our LGBTQ community. We are a very, very diverse state, maybe not racially, but that racial diversity, the lessons that people are learning and working through that issues of racial diversity translate and transpose into the other diverse communities that the state has.
I've been asking each of the groups that we're speaking with today to kind of give a personal vignette of, you know, is there some encounter or experience you've had or person you've worked with that's kind of shown you a way that you've made a difference with the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity?
Sure. And the immediate thing that comes to mind is our work with state police, which we've been working with for a little over a decade now. And where we've seen state police, you know, do succession planning to really address issues of inequity, addressing racial profiling, training and recruitment, so that state police, you know, the workforce is increasingly diverse than it was, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. But that the leadership, sort of stepping forward first with Colonel Baker and now with Colonel Tom L'Esperance, that there is a commitment to law enforcement, and they've been demonstrating that leadership by encouraging others, other sort of sheriffs and local PDs, to get the kind of training that helps to mitigate bias as it relates to racial profiling.
Is there an opportunity in the crisis that we've experienced in the last couple months here that we've seen in Ferguson and then more recently in New York City? What opportunities do you find in those tragedies?
Well, first of all, the tragedies, you know, St. Louis, New York, I think are partially born out of this sort of disconnect between communities of color and the public institutions that are in place to serve them. You know, as we look at Vermont, and specifically look at either municipal government, we're looking at Burlington or state police, the leadership in those institutions have been, particularly the state police, have been working for the better part of a decade now to cultivate strong, solid relationships with community members, be they U.S.-born or those that are part of the migrant workers or new Americans, that their work is really intentional. And we've been working with them during periods when there's been no crises, because I think core values of Vermont is, you know, we sit down and we talk to our neighbors. You know, we get to know our neighbors before there's a crisis. And state police has demonstrated year after year after year of our working with them that that they work with intention, that they pull others in. They're proactive in their getting their message out of, you know, we're there to protect and serve. And so that, you know, the bond that's being created now didn't exist or was practiced in Ferguson's or Berkeley or New York City. So that there's a less of a chance, and it doesn't mean that there still are not issues, but there's a foundation, an intentional foundation that's being built that all Vermonters should appreciate.
Okay, well, Curtis Reed from the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity, if listeners who want to support your work, how can they do that?
They can do it by going to our website, which is vermontpartnership.org, and Vermont is spelled out. Vermont Partnership is one word, and in the top right-hand corner of our homepage, there's a Donate Here button. It's bright red, so you can't miss it.
Okay, very good. Well, Curtis Reed, thanks so much for telling us about the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity.
Thank you, and have a joyous holiday.
Thanks. We're going to continue our tour around the state of people who are making a difference in the lives of Vermonters everywhere. We're going to turn now to Kim Fountain, who is with the Pride Center of Vermont. Kim, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about what the Pride Center does.
Our mission is to celebrate, educate, and advocate with and for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Vermonters. And so we're basically a statewide organization with a community space right here in downtown Burlington. We have a library, computers, and meeting spaces, and a lot of different programs for folks to access.
Now, I understand the Pride Center began in 1999 and was originally known as RU12.
Yes. Yes, it was. And a lot of folks had difficulty when they would read the name and see the name. You know, it'd be, they'd ask us if we were RU12 or RU12. And so we thought we'd create a name that better reflected who we are and what we do.
And originally, the Pride Center was started by a group of students, is that right? And was all volunteers?
It was, yes. In fact, Jackie Weinstock up at UVM ran a course where she had students do community projects. And so we had students from her course and then somebody from Middlebury College, and folks just get together, and they created the center.
What are some of the services or that you provide to LGBTQ?
Well, our core program, programs we have health and wellness, which is, includes our HIV testing and a host of other health and wellness-related issues to address some of the health disparities within the LGBTQ communities and the mainstream community. We have our Safe Space anti-violence program, which works with folks who've survived various forms of violence, whether it be like domestic violence or hate violence. We have a program for families and for people with disabilities. We have a program for elders and the transgender communities. So we have a host of core programs, and within each one of those, we have more specific work that we do.
You know, Vermont has a reputation having been the first with civil unions and one of the first with same-sex marriage, as being a place that has been sort of at the front edge of rights for LGBTQ people. But you see the whole gamut of you know, what goes on in Vermont. What's your experience of what it's like to be an LGBTQ person in Vermont, and what some of the challenges are here?
Sure. Well, overall, to focus on some of the positives, there's a really wonderful, welcoming community in Vermont. There are a lot of people who, you know, being New Englanders, perhaps, it's just about, you know, acceptance and understanding that everybody's welcome into various businesses or places of worship or wherever it may be. And so there's a really nice community with a very long history. So that's what's part of what makes it great. And we have a legislature who's been very supportive. So I don't have to do very much advocacy work here in Vermont the way that I had to do, say, in New York State. You know, with legislators, they get it. You know, they understand what needs to be done. So that is very positive, and that change happens rather quickly. So for a lot of LGBTQ folks in other states, they have to wait years before anything changes. Here in Vermont, it's relatively quick because of the process and the way our legislators is set up. On the, you know, more difficult side, what also happens in Vermont is that folks are so, we've had so many rights come our way that the shift from gaining rights and implementation on the ground level isn't always as smooth as we'd like it to be. So you might have individual practitioners or individual organizations that still give our community a very difficult time and maybe pretty biased toward members of our community. That said, you know, then what ends up happening is, you know, folks will come to us for help, and then we can advocate on their behalf. So at least there's also a community center here, which is also a positive, because a lot of states don't have community centers. And so people have a place to turn if an issue does arise. And so, and like I said, they do arise because you can't actually, just because you've legislated something doesn't mean that individuals always want to carry that, those, the spirit of that legislation through to the individual relationships. And a lot of times people may not do something that's illegal, but they may do something incredibly hurtful. And so we deal with a lot with that.
So give an example of the kind of routine, you know, sort of mundane challenges that LGBTQ Vermonters face.
Sure. So it could be something like, you know, if you're a transgender-identified person and you walk in and you want to buy some clothes and the staff give you a hard time, you know, or they give you really sly looks or, you know, just treat you in a way that sets you apart from other customers. You know, or it could be somebody's walking down the street holding hands with their partner and somebody yells out a slur. You know, or if you're employed someplace that doesn't accept LGBTQ folks, you could face being terminated. So there's a range of, and while, you know, you could fight that, it's really difficult to fight that kind of stuff. It takes a lot of energy, and it takes a lot of effort to actually address that through the legal system. And it's oftentimes when people have been traumatized around issues like that, then they don't often have the ability to fight that fight. So that kind of stuff happens.
Can you give us a story, an example of an experience you've had working at the Pride Center where you feel like you've made a difference?
Oh, sure. And this happens, I wouldn't say regularly, but often enough, so that we'll have, you know, provided a support group, for instance. It may be a support group for folks who are coming out in later life, or a support group for transgender-identified individuals. And they'll come to the group, have a really great experience, and then maybe, you know, and they might stay involved. And then 6 months later, they'll walk into my office and they'll sit down and they'll say to me, I need you to hear this, that when I started here, I was really in a lot of trouble. Like, I felt like I wasn't going to make it to the next day. And because of the groups that you guys run, I was able to find community connections. I was able to find my place in the world, and that really saved my life. And I'll tell you, those are really humbling words to hear. You know, I could have been in the middle of, you know, writing out a spreadsheet and trying to balance a budget. I'll sit down, you know, leave my desk and sit down with them for a little bit. And when they leave, I'm just, it takes me a while, you know, to get back into the day because they've just said something so profound. And that's when I realize lots of work to still do.
What is your sense of why, I mean, of the many issues out there in the world, there's really been a sea change around LGBTQ issues in terms of awareness, openness, and of course with marriage equality, legal recognition. Why do you think that's happened in the last decade or so?
You know, I think it's because there's a lot of folks who come out into families that are very diverse and that across all kinds of social and cultural identities. So, for instance, so I'm biracial, Asian, and white, and I'll see parts of my Asian community will stick together a lot of times, and that's fantastic. But with LGBTQ folks, you could have somebody born into any family of any political, religious, economic category you could imagine. And so when that becomes such a very personal issue for families and for people who know LGBTQ folks in general, I think that what ends up happening is it was much faster than for a lot of other communities that tend to remain isolated, you know, because society just enforces way too many boundaries, you know, on, say, whether it be communities of color or, you know, so... And the other, another thing that happens, too, is that because you have a lot of folks who might have been able to go into higher positions of power who are LGBTQ identified, you also have a much, there's access to power that way. Because I was thinking in terms of a similar thing in terms of birth happens with people who have disabilities. But oftentimes these folks with disabilities don't often get to rise into positions of power in the same way. So I think that access to power made a big difference.
Kim Fountain, for people who want to support the Pride Center of Vermont, how do they do that?
You can go to our website, which is www.pridecentervt.org.
And I see there is a donate button in the
upper right-hand corner. There is, yes.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing your story and telling us about the work you do with the Pride Center of Vermont.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Now we're going to turn to Cheryl Ann Linares, who is with Warrior Spirit Ranch. Cheryl Ann, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Now, I understand we are catching you on the road today.
Yeah.
Tell me what it is you're doing today.
Well, one of my stops is to be able to drop off some goodie bags to the food shelf and homeless shelter of the Upper Valley. They do a lot of service with veterans because they're so close in proximity to the VA hospital, and they work a lot with families and especially teens.
Can you tell us a little bit about what Warrior Spirit Ranch does?
Well, the Warrior Spirit Ranch is in development stages. We have acquired property that is in Walden, Vermont, and it's going to be a sanctuary for veterans.
And what gave you the inspiration to do this?
Well, partly because I was the daughter of two veterans. My dad was a decorated Marine, and my stepdad was retired Navy. So I pretty much had a lifelong experience with going through all their ups and downs with a lot of service-related experiences and illness, things that they needed to go through. And I ended up graduating Norwich University through nursing and was able to work in pretty much all the hospital settings, including the VA, and saw that there was a lot of gaps in the system and a lot of different ways that we'd be able to give that extra care to our veterans that they deserve.
So what does Warrior Spirit Ranch provide that a veteran wouldn't find elsewhere?
Well, one of the biggest things that we are spearheading is that we're going to be a facility where we can take the veterans in with no time restraints. Most of the facilities give a two-year time limit, and quite often we're finding that that's just not enough time for the veterans to be able to pull themselves together and to heal.
So give me an idea of, you know, how this actually works. So this is a home or a facility where people can live?
It's an old family farm. Unfortunately, we have four buildings that are there. We have a farmhouse and the garage. Everything's been renovated in the past 5 years. So we have a really beautiful barn that's been renovated into really large heated activity spaces, and it's got a condo above that. There's a chalet, and there's a cottage. So we're going to be able to get our licensure for both a therapeutic facility, two of the buildings, and two of the buildings will be residential facilities. We're also spearheading each building to be a specific subpopulation. So one will be for women, one will be for LGBT, one will be for men, and the little cottage is great for two people that are wheelchair-bound that want a more of a semi-private sort of setting.
And veterans can live there indefinitely?
They could. I'm not going to have any time limit. If they're in a position at no matter what age because of a disability, whether it's PTSD or traumatic brain injury, we will be able to offer them a retirement, yes.
What are some of the problems that are unique to veterans that you're seeing in the work that you do?
I would have to say that the PTSD is so unpredictable for the veterans where, especially now, like, you know, my dad and my stepdad were from Korea and Vietnam, and they had a whole bunch of issues with acceptance and a lot of the experiences and stuff that they had. But the current veterans have all been multiple deployed. So every time they get deployed, it's just a whole other layer of all these traumas and experiences and stuff that just sort of layer on top of each other. And then after they get either honorably separated or retire, they're actually falling apart a lot sooner than the veterans from the Korean and Vietnam War era. And we have the highest suicide rate compared to all the wars combined. So there's things where the stressors are just too monumental for a lot of our veterans, and we need to be able to be more supportive of them.
What's different about the current wars in the Middle East compared to past wars, Vietnam and Korea? Why is it the highest suicide rate now?
I'm not sure if they've actually been able to make a determination as why it's the highest rate. It's just the circumstances are a lot of it has to do with the bombs, the roadside bombs and the AEDs and the AIDs and all those things. People get to see a lot more body parts and things like that, really awful traumatic experiences, and there's a high rate. I believe the number was like 17,000 soldiers, men and women, were sexually abused in like 2012. So whether it's being captured or isolation, I'm not really sure, but there's just a whole lot of numbers that are being computated that are really shocking. And so the experiences are a little bit harder for everybody to get over.
Do you think that being a veteran in Vermont or in northern New England here poses any unique challenges?
Well, Vermont has the highest rate of volunteerism to be able to enlist, so I think we're going to see a lot of the numbers for Vermont a little higher than many of the other states. Also, we're very rural, and one thing in Vermont is that we have about 55,000 veterans that actually live here in Vermont, and more than half of them are from Korea and Vietnam and World War II, so most of them are elderly. So it's sort of like a mix of trying to blend the old experiences and being able to take care of them who are unemployed or unemployable to being able to help the current ones that are having a hard time adjusting to civilian life and coming back in. So we have a tremendous amount of nonprofit organizations that are working together. We're going towards this new philosophy that's called collective impact. So even with Kim from the Pride Center, we've spoke a time or two to be able to work together for us to be able to receive some people that might go to her agency to be able to help, so we can either relieve some of the pressure or be able to offer them housing and health care. We'll be one of the first facilities in Vermont to offer on-site mental health care. And we have the New England, Northeast Kingdom Community Action, and there's several other agencies that we'll be working with that are going to sort of balance each other out. So those of them that are really dependent upon the Vermont General Fund or the VA funding, the grants per diem, or some of the other Labor Department and those sorts of government-issued funds, when those funds get cut and everybody starts to struggle, we're going to try to work a lot harder together to be able to see how we can keep each other's agencies afloat.
We're talking with Cheryl Ann Linares from Warrior Spirit Ranch. What is the timeline for the Warrior Spirit Ranch's programs to be up and running?
It should be in the springtime. Our biggest hurdle right now is getting the sprinkler systems done. And with the four buildings, it just gave us a little bit of a challenge to be able to get the digging done. To be able to get that accomplished. But springtime, we should be up and running. We'll also be able to not only offer the 24 beds, but we'll be working with community members and the veterans that have housing or have somewhat stable families but need help with different kinds of health concerns, or even if they need transportation to get to doctor's appointments, whether it's local or all the way to the VA. We'll be there and be available to offer those sorts of services. They can walk into the ranch to hang out and, you know, have coffee and dinners and stuff with the other peers, because veterans know veterans best. Or we'll be able to, see what we can do to help connect them with employment and some of the other agencies for outreach.
I'm just curious, I mean, the idea of open-ended, the ability to live there open-ended, don't you worry that you're going to fill up pretty fast?
We will fill up pretty fast. Our phone rings quite frequently now, being able to find places for the beds. Our hope is that we're going to be strengths-based and be able to offer meaningful work to the veterans, to be able to, with some of them coming in crises, they might be isolated and in their room, so we'll have things like greenhouses up so they can go and water plants and sort of get themselves out of bedrooms and sort of break out of depressions and fear factors. And we'll be able to hook up with a lot of businesses in the community that are anxious and willing to hire veterans, and then just be able to get them rolling. So we hope to service as many veterans as we can.
In your work with veterans up until this point, is there an image that stands out in your mind of something that made a real difference?
It's the things that we take for granted. A lot of the current veterans that are coming back from the desert areas and stuff, they can't deal with blinking yellow lights, and they can't deal with like yellow stripes on the street because of how the traffic control and things are out there. So, and like even now, you know, there's some veterans that can't go behind a plow truck because it's going to trigger them to be able to have some experience from the desert life that they had to go through. So I think the biggest thing for that is just being mindful that sometimes, even Christmas shopping with the busyness, we have some veterans that can't go to places like Boston for special surgeries because they can't deal with the traffic and the people because of the hypervigilance that they needed to endure where they were at for their safety. They can't go to the store and enjoy the holidays the way they might have used to before they went to service. So those sorts of mindfulness things is really important to hang on to.
So if we were to talk in a year or so from now, from when you launch, what do you hope to be able to have, you know, accomplished in your first year of existence at Warrior Spirit Ranch?
In our first year, I hope that we can say that we have been able to successfully transition at least half of the veterans that had come in any particular category from crises to transitional. I hope to be able to say that we have been able to connect at least half of the veterans to gainful employment, to be able to see that they have successfully sustained either maintaining the housing that they have, that they've been able to preserve their families that have gone through all of these tensions and stresses along with them, and to be able to say that we've hooked up a lot of veterans and given them support, and maybe they've had a longer-term sobriety, being able to have that go-to clubhouse sort of place like the ranch to be able to share with each other and not feel so alone.
And just a last thing, Cheryl Ann, why do you do this? I mean, this is something that it sounds like you were not personally in combat or in the military. What moves you to want to spend your time doing this work?
I believe, outside of being an Aquarius, and I've always been a caregiver, I just feel that this is what I had done for my dads and their friends, and I don't think this is my calling. I don't think I would do anything different in my life, and I think the soldiers, the airmen, the sailors, we couldn't have the life that we have today without all the sacrifices and that blank check that they write. And I think this is just something that I can do to contribute and show my respect and my gratitude for everything that they have done for myself and my family as well.
Okay, and for people who want to support the work of Warrior Spirit Ranch, how do they do that?
Well, we do have a website. It's warriorspiritranch.org, all spelled out. And that'll be upgraded soon, but it's got a lot of information about our programs, and we'll have like a really good educational page for our students and stuff to learn about statistics. But
okay.
It covers everything. It's a really nice site.
Well, Cheryl Ann Linares, thanks for joining us to tell us about Warrior Spirit Ranch here on the Vermont
Thank
Conversation.
Thank you so much. And thanks for helping connect all the nonprofits that you're interviewing today. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, it's what we're here to do. So that does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. A happy holidays to all of our listeners, and a thanks to all the people who are making a difference in the lives of so many here in Vermont. We'll talk to you next week on the Vermont Conversation.
You've been listening to Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Listen Wednesdays at 1 as Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility.